Good to see all you here. Thanks for coming. And sorry for, just apologize to people over there that you're taking it for the team with kids camp, because this is where the screen is for kids camp. So some of you have to turn your neck quite hard. But thanks for loving the kids by doing that. We are super excited about kids camp coming up this week, and all the volunteers and all the children that are coming. And it's going to be a wonderful, wonderful time. And I'm looking forward to just a lot of the questions. I get to teach alongside Aaron Julin the Bible story time, and the kids have questions every year that I go, okay, I need to think about that. And so I love children and that they have so many good questions about theology and life and even the Bible. So we are now in our continuing in our series of Mark. After today, we're going to take a bit of a break in it. We're finishing up Mark chapter 4 today. And then next week, we're going to have the kids camp will be here. So a bunch of kids from kids camp and hopefully a bunch of their parents will be here. We're going to have a barbecue afterwards. And we're just going to do the theme of what we talked about at kids camp. And you know, it's for all ages, so look forward to having you here. The week after, we have Peter is back. He's going to come and do a one-off for free, and and he's going to come back. If you're new here, Peter has been a mentor of mine and has been the associate pastor here for the last over 6 years, and has just transitioned to retirement. And so we said, okay, once you come back from your trip across Canada, please come and speak. So he's going to be doing that. And then we're going to dive into the book of Ruth that Glenn Collins, myself, and Aaron Julin are going to unpack in about 5 weeks. So that is what we're doing this summer. And it's going to be really encouraging. And so I mentioned the other day, someone, if you want to know what's going on in Ruth, maybe start reading Judges and Ruth. And someone said to me today, they've already started reading the book of Judges. I'm like, whoa, that's some really good summer reading for you. So go keep it up. And it would be great to have the context, because I don't think it's just children that have good theological questions. I think we do. We all have good questions about life and God and us, and how does that all mix together, and how do we live a life of faith? And so we want to be people that are engaging and asking questions. Like I said last week, it's not just a download. A sermon isn't just a download that I heard on the mountaintop to God, and he spoke to me, and now I'm going to regurgitate it to you, and it's thus saith the Lord, and go do it now. No, it's something that I believe in, with humility, that God is speaking in my life, and somehow I can find a way to tease out some of the points for you, and hopefully the Spirit of God is working in our life, our lives, and teaching us what is that this life, then this word becomes a life in us, but also we're asking good questions to wrestle through these things. And so that is what we want to do here at Coast Hills Community Church all the time. So let's get back to, let's start this. It's a crossing over, the title that I've called this sermon is Crossing Over to the Other Side in the Dark During a Storm with Jesus. I could have added a few more in there, but I thought that's long enough. Crossing Over to the Other Side in the Dark During a Storm with Jesus. Let's read Mark 4, 35 to 41. That day when evening came, he said to his disciples, "Let's go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd behind, They took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. A furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat, so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him up and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." Then the wind died down, and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" They were terrified and asked each other, "Who is this? Even even the wind and the waves obey him? This is our text for this morning. I don't know, have any of you been in a boat that might have nearly capsized? It is a very frightening time. The only time that I've really done that is at Sharon's parents' cabin. You actually have to get in a car topper. So you come to this little remote place and you drive down this logging road, and then you get on it, then you take all your stuff and you get on a dock, and you have like a 40 horse hand powered, well, not hand powered, but hand steering. I don't know, you could tell I'm not a sailor, but I do have my license, and outboard, they give it to anyone, imagine that. And so then everyone piles in it, and then you got to make, we call it the crossing, then you got to do the crossing where you get in a Suburban, then you take a logging road, another 5 miles, but it takes you about 25 minutes to get to our camp. And then we're on a nice, beautiful, amazing lake. But there's this crossing. And sometimes the crossing, the waves are quite high. Berry Lake gets the wind can come up and just cause all kinds of havoc. One time I was crossing and I had to go pick someone up at the crossing. So I was in the boat alone and in this little car topper, and I forgot to put, usually they have, it's really advanced, technologically advanced the way that they do this. They have big rocks on either end. And so if you want to not be thrown, the boat, with the wind and the waves, then you take these rocks and you put them in the stern, right in the front of the boat. And is that the stern? That's the bow. I do have my license. Man. Anyway, I meant to do that. You take these rocks and you put them in the front of the boat. The bow. But there were no rocks that I saw, and I thought, oh, no problem. It looks pretty good, because in the bay, it looks fine. And then all of a sudden, you come to the open space, and it was just like wind and rain and waters coming out, and I felt like Relic, and I lost my hat. I didn't go back to get it, and the boat felt like it was coming up and then slamming down and coming up, and I it felt like the boat was almost 90 degrees a couple times. I was like, whoa. I just had to pull over, and I was like, okay, what am I new? Well, I moved over to this, moved over to the side where the wind and rain, but you don't want to go to the side because that's where the rocks are, right? So I took it, went over there, pulled the thing up, and just sat and caught my breath. So I've been to a place like that before, but I don't know if it was as drastic as this story that we have here. You get the point. Thanks for entertaining me with your laughter and your grace. Sharon, we'll make it across the crossing. But what I also want us to know is that in that time, ancient Near East, we need to understand what water and raging storms symbolized for them as well. So not only did they have this fear that this boat was literally going to be swamped and they're going to be coming under, but they had a couple other things that they were thinking about. I grew up in southern Ontario, and I had cousins that lived in Saginaw, Michigan. And we would get to Saginaw about 3 or 4 times a year. My cousins, I think the youngest was maybe 15 years older than me and our brothers and sisters, my brothers and sister. And we would get there, and my one cousin, he loved kind of like cult classic movies, and he actually had like a real projector with like real film that he would play, and he'd want, every time we'd get there, like, come on, you gotta come watch this film. And it's like, because nobody else would watch it. And so we would, and I'm like, okay, I'm like 9 or 10 years old. Hi, Mike, well, what kind of movie is it? It's called The Creature from the Black Lagoon. I'm like, whoa. If you haven't heard about it, like, you should Google it. Not now. Watch it later and be terrified. But what would happen, it was all I remember, that was really cheesy special effects. But there would always be some poor person that would either be walking near the lagoon or on a romantic canoe ride in the lagoon, or going for a swim, maybe a skinny dip, in the lagoon. That's why I don't look at it now. And what was happening? There was always a monster lurking. The creature from the Black Lagoon was always lurking. And you know the rest of the story, right? It would be quiet, silence. At just the right time, you go, there should be a monster here. And then there isn't. And then it comes and scares you. And it grabs them and brings them down. And you're like, whoa. They had even a deeper fear and appreciation for the sea than that. In the ancient Near East, can you throw the picture of the creature, Black Lagoon? That's it right there. Wow, so high tech. In ancient Near East, they had a fear as well. And it would seem something like that, but even deeper. In medieval Jewish folklore, there was this monster called Rahab. It was a mythical sea monster, a dragon of the waters. And this is where the demonic angel of the sea lived. Rahab is also seen as a deity in some of the texts as well. That this was a god that other gods would fight with. And Babylonian culture would speak of this as well. And they'd have these gods fighting each other. And then later, Rahab became a particular demon to inhabit the sea. She maybe looked like that. And it was especially associated with the Red Sea. So the sea is associated with death, monsters, and absolute chaos for the Jews and the reading of the text. So not only do you have this, you also have the reason, okay, why is this happening? Why does the storm come up? Why did it come up so fast? The Sea of Galilee is put in between a bunch of hills, and it's a small sea, and what would happen was, even to this day, they say it would come up, and their wind would swirl, and a quick storm could happen very quickly. So we need to understand that they're thinking this way as well. It might not be like that, but they had a picture in their head of what might want to come and take them to death. We also need to know that during Mark 4 in here, there's also echoes of Jonah 1. Now, it's not going to be on screen, but if you have a Bible or a Bible app, you can open it up. I'm gonna quickly read through Jonah 1 because I think we need to understand this. Jonah 1 says this. The word of the Lord came to Jonah. Go to the great city of Nineveh and preach against it because its wickedness has come up before me. But Jonah ran away from the Lord and headed to Tarshish. He went down to Joppa, where he found a ship bound for that port. After paying the fare, he went aboard and sailed for Tarshish to flee from the Lord. Then the Lord sent a great wind on the sea, and such a violent storm arose that the ship threatened to break. All the sailors were afraid, and each cried out to his own God, and they threw cargo into the sea to lighten up the ship. But Jonah had gone below the deck, where he lay down and fell asleep into a deep sleep. The captain went to him and said, "How can you sleep? Get up and call on your God. Maybe he will notice us to see that we will not perish." Then the sailors said to each other, "Come, let us cast lots and find out who's responsible for this calamity." They cast lots, and the lot fell on Jonah. So as they asked him, "Tell us who is responsible for making all this trouble for us. What kind of work do you do? Where do you come from? What is your country? From what people are you?" He answered, "I'm a Hebrew, and I worship the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land." This terrified them and asked, "What have you done?" They knew he was running away from the Lord because he had already told them so. The sea was getting rougher and rougher. So they asked him, "What should we do to you to make the sea calm down for us?" "Pick me up and throw me into the sea," he replied, "and it will become calm. I know that it's my fault that this great storm has come upon you." Instead, the men did their best to row back to land, but they could not, for the sea grew even wider than before. They were pulling to the side. Then they cried out to the Lord, "Please, Lord, do not let us die for taking this man's life. Do not hold us accountable for killing an innocent man, for you, Lord, have done as you pleased." Then they took Jonah and threw him overboard, and the raging sea grew calm. As this, the men greatly feared God, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows to him. Then Jonah was provided a huge fish to swallow Jonah, and Jonah was in the belly of the fish for 3 days and three nights. Do you see some of the same similarities? Let's walk through them. One, they're both in boats crossing over to a culture that is very different than from their own. Two, there's a sudden storm that rages. Three, the prophets are sleeping. Four, the owners of the boat need to wake them up. Five, the men are worried for their lives. The verb to die in verse 38 in Mark 4 is the same verb used in Jonah 1:6 and 1:14. Then six, the storm suddenly is calmed. And seven, the men are terrified or fear or filled with fear. And there's also some contrasts that are happening as well. Jonah is not choosing to go where he's supposed to be going, to people that are other than him. He didn't want God to save them. Jesus says to his disciples, "Come on, let's go to the other side. The side where you're going to find pigs grazing openly." That Jews could not stand that. That's unclean for them. In chapter 5, you're going to see Jesus coming up to, and they're going to be in a cemetery, a gravesite, another place where you would not go as a Jew, especially to Gentiles. And so I want us to, we're going to tweak and look at both of these stories a little bit. As we look at the other side, there's a quote that came up on here. If you could pull it all up, Dave, by Ched Myers. He says, "There are four crossing journeys in the first half of Mark. Ched Myers suggests that the function of this crossing pattern is to dramatize the fact that despite their cultural and political otherness, Mark's Jesus is determined to bring liberation to those on the other side." Other is anything that is not me. Other. Think about that. How comfortable do you feel around people that are just a bit different than you? I used to think I was really good with that, and I realized that sometimes I have this trouble doing that. And I think our bent is to be with people of our own tribe. Our bent is to be with people that are like us. And I don't want us to miss this point in this story, that there is another side that Jesus is calling us to and saying, "Come, would you join me?" Jesus invites us to move toward this other, whatever that might be for us as a church community, but also as you as individuals. I wonder if that's a challenge for us to head over to the other side with Jesus. Jonah ran away. Jonah, and even if you look at Jonah's prayer, Jonah's just like livid. These are people that he hates. He says, "I'm not going there." Might God be calling us corporately, or maybe even you individually, to somehow be associated with the other in the weeks and months to come? It's really interesting. I didn't know this as I was preparing this sermon, and we thought about using preaching on the book of Ruth, and that's really what the book of Ruth is about. How the other, Ruth, saves the person, Naomi, who's in need. But more to that. We're going to say more about that. There's a purpose for crossing. Jonah's going the wrong way. Jesus is going the right way. Jesus is doing the will of the Father. Jesus prayed this prayer. It's not in this, obviously, in the story, but your kingdom come, your will be done as on earth as it is in heaven. Jesus says quite often, my work is to do the will of the Father. So if we see where we see Jesus going and what he's doing, what he's doing is living out the heartbeat with hands and feet of the Father. What Jesus is doing and who he's moving to is always reflective of the heartbeat of the Father, always. This is why our church, I love that we want to discover who Jesus is and we want to follow him. We're going to find out a little bit later that it's actually harder than sometimes we might think. And that's okay, because Jesus isn't finished with us yet. I'm going to move on to another point here. A sleeping faith, a trust. I wonder if Jonah was sleeping in the boat out of avoidance. I don't want to deal with it. But I wonder if Jesus is sleeping out of a calmness, faith. It's okay. We can do this. But the disciples are wondering, and you got to ask the question, how could Jesus be sleeping while such a dangerous storm is overwhelming them in the boat and the disciples? Interesting enough that this is the only time the New Testament records Jesus is sleeping. So if that happens, we want to pay attention. And I wonder if Mark might be trying to point to Jesus' humanity right before he reveals how divine he is by stilling the waters. The disciples wake him up by calling him teacher. Teacher! For that's what he is. But the question at the end of the story points to the possibility that Jesus is actually more than a teacher. And in fact, what he does with the storm shows us that. So I wonder if they're saying, teacher, they might not actually be wanting Jesus to calm the storm. They're just like, dude, get up, grab a bucket, start bailing, we're going to die. Why isn't she joining in here? And I wonder if sometimes we think that. Although the big picture of the story is about Jesus' intention to cross over to the other side and to reveal that he is the Lord of the sea, and to herald the good news to Gentiles, people that are other, we can also ask the individual personal devotional question here. During the storms of my own life, why does it seem like God is sleeping? Do I see him just as teacher? Or might I see him as Lord of the storm as well? One thing we can take from the disciples is that Jesus is okay to be woken up. And for those of us that maybe feel that God is sleeping during this time in our lives, I want to encourage you with this quote. Jesus is asleep in the boat, but he's in the boat. It seems like he's absent, but he's always present. Would we hang on to that? Metaphorically, what kind of storms are you drifting in currently right now? What's your anxiety level at? Does Jesus need to be awakened in your life? And what might that look like? Then Jesus is awake in the story, storm. He wakes up and he calms the storm. Jesus is not just a good teacher. He's Lord of the sea. He's Lord of the abyss. He's Lord of Rahab. He's Lord of every deity that they would conjure up that is lurking in the deep sea. Mark is using this story to encourage the readers that Jesus is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Even the abyss. Even when great monsters like Rahab and Leviathan, and dare I say, the Loch Ness Monster, lurk, and live, even where evil seeks to steal, kill, and destroy. Jesus is the Lord of all. Tim Gettert writes this: when Jesus calms the storm on the Sea of Galilee, he is foreshadowing God's victory over all his enemies. This is what we also want to understand, the big picture. That in the midst of it, Jesus is the Lord of the sea. He's Lord of the abyss. He's Lord of the unknown. He's Lord of the uncertainty that's going to well up and surprise us and want to try to drag us down. According to verse 39, Jesus tells the sea and the wind to be calm. The literal mean is be muzzled. And it's the same words that he used to heal the demonic person earlier. And according to Job 26, Psalm 104:7, Isaiah 51:9-10, Revelation 15, God is the one who has authority over the sea. Revelation 15, it talks about the victory of God. And you know what the image that John uses? The sea was like glass. It's like glass. Psalm 104:7 says, But at your rebuke the waters fled, and at the sound of your thunder they took flight. And then it goes on talking about how God overcame Rahab. So in the Jewish mind, in the ancient Near East, only God can calm the sea. Interesting enough, Jesus is here doing this without prayer. Jesus is doing this without asking and pleading God to do anything. He says it with his words. And so what happens? Then the disciples are like, who is this? He calms the storm. Now he needs to calm his disciples. It seems as if it's easier for Jesus to calm the storm than to calm his wily disciples that have their own free will and their own choice to choose what they may. He asks them a question. Why are you afraid? Where's your faith? Have you been watching me heal the sick and call out demons and announce the good news all the while? Mark might say from chapter 1 to chapter 4. Haven't you seen this? Don't you understand? And he's wanting them to know and understand this. And Mark actually is writing this in a time when the disciples and the church is being persecuted. And it's interesting that during the second and third centuries, the persecuted church in Rome, in the catacombs where they were hiding, they drew a lot of things, but a couple things that they drew on the walls were a boat on a storm-tossed sea. And they were symbolizing the beleaguered church, reminding themselves that the raging tempest will not last forever. And so as we look at this, I look at my faith and I'm going, oh, yeah, my faith isn't there. I don't always get there. I don't always want to go to the other side. And when I'm going to the other side, I wonder where God is. And what is this looking like? The disciples' faith, interesting enough here, had nothing to do with them being saved. Jesus did that. Life does not depend on whether or not we have enough faith. And for many of us, including myself, that is very good news. Faith as a mustard seed, something small. So Jesus is still acting as a savior, even in the midst of lack of faith. I don't know about you, but sometimes I compare myself to others. And why don't I have enough faith for this? And if I think hard enough, would this happen? And would that happen? And then would that happen? Instead of realizing, you know what? Jesus is actually with me now. And for us as a church, we have the Spirit of God to instill in us to live a life that is full of faith. So this isn't about get your act together and don't do what the disciples did. It might be saying, you know what, you might be doing what the disciples are doing. And Jesus is in the middle of saving you anyway. Wow, that's good news. And maybe, guess what? There's more boat rides that they do. And there's more crossings that they do to go to the other side. And Jesus continues to work with them, even in the midst of their lack of faith. So I don't read this, there's a bit of a scolding, but I don't read it as, what's with the little faith? It's more like, oh, don't you have the faith? Don't you see who I am? Would you be prepared to discover who I am even more? And maybe your faith would be built up a little bit more so that you would be able to follow me where I'm going to lead you? Could you do that? I wonder if that's maybe what God is saying. It's very presumptuous of me to be able to even say that. But I think that's maybe how it needs to be nuanced. I'm the Lord of the sea. There's nothing that can separate you in all of creation, neither height nor depth, or angels or demons, nakedness, famine, the sword, nothing, Romans 8. I got you. So in the midst of this little faith that you have, would you trust me? And would you follow me to where I'm calling you to go? Would you have that kind of faith? Faith that still asks questions. Who are you, Jesus? Whoa. Because it's in the awe of discovering who Jesus is that will lead our feet to follow him. I really believe that. For Mark here, the key point is that the man who will later be crucified, the man who without prayer to God and Jesus in God's name commands the wind and the sea, he is the divine man who represents the true God represents the true God who ultimately allows himself to die on behalf of all creation, all others, for the sake of love. Just as the disciples didn't get it, this Jesus will continue to live out his mission of love to the entire world. And they will be continually discovering who Jesus is as they ask this question, who is this? And as we see in the chapter ahead, they're going to be following Jesus to parts they don't want to go. Parts that they've been told and schooled all their life, don't go there. They let the hogs run free. That's unclean. Don't go to the unclean where there's demonics that are bound by chains in the graveyard. Don't go there. Jesus says, follow me. This King Jesus is with us as we faithfully cross over to the other side with him. Storms may rage, darkness may fall, panic may set in. But Jesus is with us, and that changes everything. What crossings might Jesus be calling you to make with him? What are your fears? What might give you the faith to trust Jesus that he's in the boat with you? And in the midst of the little faith that you have, would we with joy follow a Savior that came for the entire world? Would we be willing to do that? We're looking forward to, as a church, in the weeks and months to come, as we unpack that we believe in these three things. We want to be Jesus-centered. We want to live and create gracious space. And we want to live in generous love. How we believe that about Jesus, it will change what we do and how we act and how God is going to install and plant these things inside of us. We haven't done something like this in a little while, but during this, I'm going to ask the band to come up. And this idea of moving and crossing, and you might not be comfortable with this, and that's okay, then that's all right. But I think one of my jobs as a pastor, function as a pastor, is to leave space for people to respond to what the Spirit might be calling you, right? It isn't just you come here and you listen to a guy for, you know, 35 minutes and you leave and that's great. We really believe that actually God's Spirit is here and he wants to change our hearts. Mind it. Otherwise, it's just me working on this thing and it's making me change. And yet I really think that this is happening for us. And so I've asked a few people if they'd be willing to pray with some of us. And so Irvin, Christine, and Debbie and Don will be at the back, and myself as well. We'd love to pray with you. And there might be a couple things. Maybe there's a storm raging in your life right now, and you're like, I can't see the way out. I really don't think Jesus is in the boat with me. Maybe it's prayer for you in that way. But I also think that maybe there's, for some of us, Jesus is actually calling you to cross, calling you out to faith, to cross to the other side, maybe to love someone that you really don't want to, maybe forgive someone that you really don't think is forgivable. Maybe there's a movement that God's been working in your life through the book of Mark that going, I want to move that way. We'd love to pray for you for that as well. You might not even know what it is. But I believe that there's been seeds that have been planted in our hearts while we've been going through the book of Mark. And we'd love to pray for you in that way too. So that we'll be at the back. You don't have to come forward in that way. We're going to sing this last song. And then after, I'll have a benediction for us. So let's pray. Jesus, thank you for your love for us. In that you're with us, even in the midst of us and our unfaithfulness. We want to be faithfully unfaithful, if that makes sense. We want to be people that continue to ask questions and know that our faith isn't big enough or full enough or as big as it should be, yet we want to be faithful to know that you're with us. So would you work in our life in that way? For those of us that have storms in our life that are walking through right now, when we feel like, where are you? I pray that we'd be encouraged that you might not stop the storm right now. You might not calm it, but you are Lord of the storm and Lord over all. Move us forward as a church, as individuals. Would you speak your word in our lives that we might be able to discover you? And Jesus, help us to follow you. We pray this in your name. Amen.